You're watching Double Standards with me, Afshin Ratansi. This week, an exclusive. We discover startling new letters in the Gaddafi compound about golf clubs and nuclear bombs. And we gauge what's really happening in Syria. Coming up in the show, our team in Tripoli discover new letters in the Gaddafi compound from David Cameron, President Obama's shortest speech ever, and we go to Syria with the help of a member of the British Syrian Society. What he says doesn't quite tally with what we've been hearing in the mainstream media. Up next, Britain's Foreign Secretary. Welcome, Foreign Secretary, to Double Standards. Let's begin with your government. We understand that you've been sacking everyone in the Foreign Office who seeks peace, justice and a more equitable world.
We're busily engaged in doing all of that and doing it right across the government. On top of that, we are dealing with this momentous change in the Arab world.
But why? Surely you would need people seeking those values when coming to terms with the Arab awakening. Some say we need a British spring in the overthrow of this government.
There isn't the same call from the Arab League or the same degree of agreement on the United Nations Security Council.
So Britain is safe then, but is it true that your leader dined with the Gaddafi family and he didn't like their table manners? What were your exact words at the time?
I do fear they have taken the wrong fork.
And that's why you supported the bombing of Libya, just using the wrong fork at dinner. Was it really such a big deal?
That is, I have argued, the main event so far of the 21st century. It's more important than the 2008 financial crisis and its implications. It's more important than 9/11 and its long-term consequences.
Using the wrong fork gives you an excuse to steal all Libya's oil and other Arab nations as well.
We will see it go on, I think, for many years to come in its effects, both on the Arab nations and on perhaps many other nations in the world.
And so what do you advise people about the Arab Spring? Should they personally be making money out of the awakening? Should initial payments for oil be seen like an advance into their bank accounts? How big of an advance? $100 million? A billion? Just stolen from the Arab people?
It is a huge opportunity that if it happens successfully, well, then it will be a great advance in human affairs, in global policy. It will be a huge advance.
So it's a good thing to invade countries and steal their resources.
We should be very clear about that. It is a good thing in so many ways. And I was encouraged by what I saw when I visited Benghazi.
Well, you certainly have economic problems here in Britain. What do you want to do to the rioters? You can't render them to Libya with MI6 like you used to. Should they be tortured in Britain?
That is what Britain has been advocating, and we're pleased that the revised European neighbourhood policy adopts a lot of the ideas we've been putting forward.
What, torture in Britain?
This should be seen as positive change.
So what's happened to those opposing your government?
Many thousands of people could have been massacred.
What? That's terrible. It tallies with your support for the Iraq war, though.
It was in our national interest to act.
Well, with recent confirmation that you had MI6 and SAS in Libya, have you tried to sneak them into Syria yet?
The handling of Syria has been much more difficult. We and our European partners and the United States have been stepping up the pressure on the Syrian regime.
You're calling for President Assad's head, even though he has been steadfast in his support for the Palestinian people. What do you want for Syria?
Violence, torture, arbitrary rule.
So that's what you want? And any government that supports the Palestinians or UN resolutions on Palestine has to go?
They won't, of course, be able to stay in power on that basis.
Thank you, William Hague, Foreign Secretary of Britain. I think viewers of Double Standards will be shocked by what you've said. Nevertheless, I believe you have a message especially for them.
We want to hear your views. You can contact me on Twitter. You can contact the Foreign and Commonwealth Office on Facebook or on Twitter. And we always do want to hear your views. They do make a difference to us. Thank you.
A very odd request to our viewers from William Hague there. I wonder how many of you will contact him. They are cracking down on Twitter and Facebook here in the UK, so maybe it would be best just to call him. Come to think of it, banning social networking in Britain isn't the worst of it. The police shot dead Mark Duggan, which sparked the biggest riots in Britain for a quarter of a century. Since that murder, British police managed to kill a further three people over an eight-day period using pepper spray and taser guns. Let's have a look at the man who brought taser guns to Britain.
This is Peter Boatman in the checked shirt in 2003, demonstrating the effectiveness of the taser for the BBC. This morning he was found dead in his home in Northampton after apparently taking his own life. He'd been the pioneer of the taser in England and Wales, and his company Protect Systems was given the only license to import the weapons into the country. The most commonly used taser is the X26, which is the size of a handgun. But the Home Office had been testing a shotgun-style version called the X12, which has a much longer range.
I wonder if he used the long-range shotgun taser to kill himself. Anyhow, I don't think he killed himself over the deaths caused by his tasers. It turns out his suicide was because he lost his contract to supply the British police. Perhaps they get them from America now.
President Obama. At the G20 conference, police used a controversial sonic cannon on peaceful protesters. And now it's being reported that police may soon be cleared to use a laser that makes one feel as if their skin is on fire.
Well, that sounds pretty cool.
But sir, the sound cannon has been known to damage eardrums and cause aneurysms, and the skin-burning laser can cause zippers and buttons to singe people and fuse contact lenses to people's eyeballs. How on earth is using those on American citizens a good idea?
Well, like I said, it just sounds pretty cool. Hey, what other crazy weapons do we have back there?
Maybe the president should think less about tasers and more about unemployment. His job speech to Congress last week was hardly FDR's New Deal.
Now's the time to jumpstart job creation.
Saving and creating jobs have to continue to be our focus in 2010. I'm not going to rest. My administration's not going to rest in our efforts to help people who are looking to find a job.
His laser focus has been jobs, 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 jobs.
Jobs, jobs, jobs.
Jobs, jobs, jobs.
I noticed the press yesterday, because we had this jobs forum in the White House, they said, Obama's finally pivoting to jobs.
The president's been focused on jobs. He works on jobs every day.
I think we are past the crisis point in the economy, but we now have to pivot and focus on jobs.
Month after month, year after year, and Obama makes the same promises. This week, he was at the UPS courier headquarters in Georgia, trying to persuade everyone the economy is just fine.
Nearly 2 years after one of the worst recessions in our history, certainly the worst one in our lifetimes, our economy is showing signs of real strength. It was wonderful seeing some of these trucks and cars that were back here, and I was getting the... God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
First time we've seen Obama running out of words for a while, stuck for words because he couldn't fool that audience. Maybe he's worried about the $14.3 trillion debt ceiling. You know what? He could have actually solved it. He had the head of the IMF in an American jail. Couldn't they have just set bail for him at $14.3 trillion? This, courtesy of Next Media Animation Limited.
The allegations have sunk Strauss Kahn's presidential ambitions and have all but ruined his reputation and career. But heartened by the recent acquittal of two NYC policemen on rape charges, his lawyer must be hopeful their man gets off.
And get off he did. The Americans let him go. And the whole of NATO seems to have let a lot go the other day. Instead of MI6 and the CIA chasing after the papers that revealed their close collaboration with the Gaddafi government, embarrassingly for them, it was actually Human Rights Watch that got hold of them first.
The documents we found start off, you know, their faxes saying, "Dear Musa, thanks for the oranges you sent us. They were delicious." Those kind of cozy relationship with the intelligence service known for torturing and disappearing people.
The secret files reveal the two-way relationship between Libya and the UK and Libya and the United States. They show that MI6 passed on details of exiled opponents to the Gaddafi regime, and British officials apparently helped draft a speech for Colonel Gaddafi.
The British government actually wrote speeches for Gaddafi. No wonder he was beginning to sound like Tony Blair. Or was it the other way around? Anyway, Orange? Here's one of the oranges that Gaddafi's intelligence services sent to MI6. They do taste good. I heard CIA got watermelons. Meanwhile, our very own double standards team have been down on the ground in Tripoli and have found this letter from the British Prime Minister. Dear Muammar, I wonder if you could return the golf clubs I left in your tent. Thanks for the great holiday. Looks like we got away with it, as everyone over here thinks I was in Italy. Something has come up over the oil contracts, but I'll let you know next time I see you, perhaps in Holland. I'll try and get the three armored tank divisions, the couple of aircraft carriers, and the Trident nuclear bomb for you, but much of our stuff doesn't actually work, you know. Let's keep this secret friendship under wraps, just like you did with Tony and Gordon. Much love, David. So David Cameron is actually still pals with Gaddafi. Is the whole Libyan operation a cover so they can attack Syria? They wouldn't dare. But Cameron and Obama do keep threatening Syria. Up next, Ammar Waqaf, just back from the capital, Damascus. He gives us a somewhat different take on what's been happening in that linchpin of the Middle East. With me is Ammar Waqaf from the British Syrian Society. Welcome to the show. Syria, that country that hardly featured in the news, say, a year ago, everywhere in the news today. Why do you think it's featuring so prominently on news schedules on every TV station, seemingly?
Well, the Arab Spring that started in Tunisia has spread out. People in the Arab world think now that they can do it. So it has spread, the unrest, in a sense, or the revolution, if you want to put it that way, has spread a little bit, and it has reached Syria. In Syria, there are other elements from the genuine uprising of the people against what they believe to be, you know, not so many available political freedoms and so on, perhaps corruption and so on as well. But there are regional players who are playing, so they have prolonged and complicated the matter worse, and it's now basically on a daily basis on the news. So we're a bit unfortunate.
Because the average viewer would get the impression that the best thing for Syria would be the same thing that happened in Egypt, and that Syria can be put in the same box like Egypt, like Tunisia, like Libya. How would you draw the comparisons between Syria and whether it's a special case?
Syria is a bit different. You have Syria is a multi-ethnic society, and when you have regional stakeholders who are interested, who have a vested interest in getting Syria out of this turmoil in a shape.
So are those other countries multi-ethnic?
Oh yes, in a sense, but the issue with Syria is that it has so long been associated with anti-Israeli, not so pro-American approach, and some regional stakeholders would want to change that, and some international powers as well would love to change that, and the way to change it, unfortunately, has been to take Syria and put it, or to place the Syrian plateau, in a sense, or open the Syrian plateau into a wider conflict of a sort of sectarian tension and rope pulling in the region between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Now, Syria, the problem is that if Syria falls a victim and becomes indeed an arena for such a struggle between a Sunni struggle or a Shiite struggle, it will basically cease to exist, in a sense. Well, that's a worst case scenario. And that is complicating matters a lot. And basically, the Syrian government and the Syrian state cannot allow for a sectarian regional war to be, you know, reflected inside, because basically Syria will be divided alongside those wars, just like what happened in Lebanon. And that's why what happened perhaps had Syria been left alone, it would have happened. We don't know. But so many people, so many stakeholders sticking their nose into it has made it a lot complex.
How popular is the opposition in Syria?
Well, it depends on what you
the
define.
The opposition to the government of President Assad.
Yeah, there is no such thing as a unified opposition. You have key figures inside Syria who have always been, you know, voicing out the need for liberalism, perhaps more political freedoms and so on. And you have those people who are outside Syria. Some of them actually are here in London. And those people, either side is not so popular with the other, so there are differences.
And why is it portrayed then in the media that they are the same, and that all the people marching, whether in Latakia or Homs or Damascus, I'm not sure whether there are big demonstrations in Damascus, they all want the same thing, is certainly how the media is portraying it.
There is certainly a very near future target that everybody is seeking, which is to topple the government. But their point of view, where they are coming from, is so different, and where they want to head ahead is so different as well. So they do meet, yes, in this particular specific objective, which is to topple the government. But other than that, they don't meet at all, because some of them are Islamic, some of them are too liberal, some of them are democratic, some of them are only interested in perhaps, like, you had in the 70s and 80s, you had problems with Muslim extremists who have been expelled outside the country. They just want to go in and prove they had been all, you know, right all along.
Some of our international viewers who will be watching the international media, some of it supplied by, say, Al Barada Television and so forth, are saying President Assad is ordering the killing of people every single day. How do you respond to the reports of continuous killing in Syrian cities?
Well, the first fact that we have to look at in this regard is that up to one third of the casualties have been from the army and from the intelligence.
And you've been in Syria recently?
I have been in Syria. I've just come back like 3 weeks ago. And we visited, actually, the Syrian Social Club. It was part of an initiative by the Syrian Social Club. We visited the Tishreen Military Hospital, where we visited...
That scene is just propaganda by the Syrian government, what you're saying.
Well, I just did it, you know, I've cried my heart out inside that hospital, because these are people who were shot at, definitely by the demonstrators, and who fell victim, and their colleagues, their comrades, in a sense, or their, you know, brothers in arms, they fell dead. And once...
So how is it human rights groups are saying this is all lies, it's just demonstrators who are being killed?
We demonstrated outside the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. We told them in a previous letter that we handed over in a previous demonstration that there are extremists in Syria. They've replied back, Foreign and Commonwealth Office, they've replied back and they said, yes, there are armed extremists in Syria, and we acknowledge that the army gets, you know, under fire from these thing, from these groups occasionally. We delivered a message, it was delivered to Mr. William Hague, saying, look, you know, one third of the casualties doesn't say that this is an occasional coming under fire. And we have to know that people of the army are not there to kill people. Had they been there to kill people, we would have been talking about tens of thousands of casualties of civilians rather than, you know, 100 here maximum or a 10 here or so. Intelligence, when they enter a city, what happens really is that those armed groups, they seal off a city. And what happens is that they force people to, you know, close their shops, you know, as if there is a general strike. They really control the lives of those people inside those cities. And those people have the right for the government, you know, to come in and release them from that pressure.
Okay, well, if the information we're getting from the media doesn't suggest what you're saying, who benefits from the kind of information that is being supplied to the media, whether it be the American-financed stations broadcasting from Syria? Cui bono is, of course, the question. And who might be supplying the weapons to these demonstrators that are shooting the armed services of the Syrian government?
Well, who benefits is that everybody has a vested interest in keeping the international, how do you say, public opinion poised against Syria, like the BBC, for example. They do not portray the picture as it is. So, for example, a demonstration goes in Damascus where they hold a 2.3-kilometer Syrian flag, an enormous support for the Syrian president and for the current Syrian government. And BBC reports it as 2,000 feet. Now, a week after, just one day after the president delivered his 20th of June reform program in a speech in Damascus University, millions of people took to the streets. In Damascus, there was this huge demonstration in the Umayyad Square, and the Syrian TV had to use a helicopter to show the enormity of the situation. We were talking about at least 1.5, 2 million people in that square. And what did the BBC show? Just a few tens of people holding President Bashar's...
I know viewers will be used to this kind of bias, but what do you think goes through the heads of journalists on the ground, or these journalists here in London, because they aren't allowed into Syria and are monitoring the situation in Syria from afar through their sources. What do you think goes through their minds as to why they can be so obviously biased?
I actually don't know. We demonstrated as well as a group, the Syrian Social Club, outside Bush House, BBC, World Service building. And we told them, is there a specific reason why 9 out of 10 of your guests are all anti-Syrian government? Is there a specific reason why, you know, you show only the videos that the opposition is showing? They said, well, we do not have journalists on the ground. We said, well, like a few years back and during the Gaza war, it was the same situation. The Israelis were bombing Gaza and you were not showing. There isn't the lucrative element in Syria as in Libya or Iraq. We do not have that much oil, you know, for someone to come in and force their companies into the country afterwards. That's one thing.
But the neutralization of Hezbollah is one of the big aims of the big superpowers.
Yes. The other thing is the destabilization, just like you said, destabilization of the region. They know that if they, you know, go hawkish and send troops and no-fly zones and all that stuff, the Syrian government might interpret that as not really interested in the Syrian people's welfare, but actually interested in disarming Syria for the benefit of Israel and a peaceful solution in the region that would cancel the refugees, the Palestinian refugees' right to go back, because you simply get, you know, pluck out the teeth out of everybody else. So they might be afraid that Syria might have a last, you know, stand or whatever it is, or a final stand on this, and cause some problems in the region. They might think that if the Syrian government is cornered, they might, you know, the Syrian president did say it in his recent or most recent speech. He did say, in a sense, had they thought that it would have been a walk in the park, they would have done it a long time ago.
Thank you very much for coming on Double Standards.
OK, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Syria, not the way it's seen on most media these days. This month, of course, marks a decade since 9/11. America may not have been attacked, but nearly 80 US soldiers were wounded in Afghanistan on the eve of the anniversary. And their embassy in Kabul got hit just days later. Well, 9/11 saw the opening of the US torture center in occupied Cuba at Guantanamo Bay. Here's President Obama, 3 months after his inauguration, issuing an executive order promising to close it down within a year.
Promptly to close the detention facility at Guantanamo consistent with the national security and foreign policy interests of the United States and the interests of justice, I hereby order. And we then provide the process whereby Guantanamo will be closed no later than 1 year from now.
Well, nearly 3 years on, Guantanamo is still there with no sign of it closing down. Another pledge unfulfilled. You can email us at comment@doublestandardstv.com. I'll leave you with Politzoid's take on Guantanamo Bay. See you next week.